Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, hosting Mark Chancy, an expert on constitutional, political, and academic issues related to the study of religion in public schools. Chancy's appearance in the Todd Weir Center is Tuesday, October 4th at 4:30 and is open to the public. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. There's been considerable conversation all across the country, in locker rooms, across kitchen tables, politicians even entering the fray, discussing the game of football. We are beginning to realize in a more profound way just how dangerous the game of football remains, even with the advent of better helmets and other means to try to make it a safer game. It still remains a very dangerous sport. In a new book called Lasting Impact, Kostia Kennedy mentions the fact that in the course of a single calendar year, 11 high school players died in football injuries. It speaks to a high level of risk and also prompts the question of what compels so many young people to continue to play this game, even if more and more of them are probably more and more aware of the risks that are involved of very serious injury and potentially even death. There's all kinds of things that go into the game of football and the hold which it has on such a large swath of the American public. And that is part of the fascinating story told in this new book called Lasting Impact, One Team, One Season, What Happens When Our Sons Play Football. In this particular book, Kostia Kennedy takes us through the 2014 season of New Rochelle High School's Huguenots, a very, very successful football team. And along the way, we learn a lot about the game and about some of its darker aspects as well. Kostia Kennedy may be familiar to you for a couple of different wonderful books he's written, including 56, Joe DiMaggio and the Last Magic Number in Sports, and Pete Rose and American Dilemma, both bestsellers. He also had a significant hand in Super Bowl 50, and he and I had the chance to speak about that. A former senior writer and assisting manager editor at Sports Illustrated, now an editorial director at Time Incorporated, the author of Lasting Impact. Kostia Kennedy, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
It's great to be on with you. Thanks for having me.
You write towards the very end, beginning of this book, "I came to writing this book without an agenda, but with high curiosity." Explain what exactly you were curious about, and also say a word about the agenda that you tried to sort of leave out of the equation as you sat down to write it.
Well, I think that, you know, like many things in sports and in politics, you know, people sort of have a preconceived notion sometimes that they feel very strongly one way or the other. In this case, there were people who were really against the idea of having their kids play football because of the physical dangers and risks. And on the other side, there were people who were very much pro football and, oh, you know, it's not as dangerous as it seems and all of that. And so I tried to not want to – I didn't want to advocate for football, nor did I want to advocate against. So no agenda in that way. And really what I was curious about is the sort of – you know, beyond the fun of watching football, which many people, myself included, really enjoy watching the NFL and watching football at any level. It's a terrific game. What were players getting out of it? What were they pulling from it? Curious to really see it at the ground level. We tend to focus a lot on the NFL, of course. It's highly visible. But there are 2,000 players in the NFL. There's 1.1 million kids who are playing high school football. So as a way to really look at this experience in American life and the way it's touching families and touching livelihoods, that's where the curiosity was, to see what it was like. And you know, New Rochelle is, as you mentioned just a moment ago, it is a successful program on a public high school level in New York, but it's not a football factory. You're not playing under big, huge lights of a fancy arena and fancy stadium in Texas or anything like that. It's not highly pressurized in that sense at all. It's just a good public high school program. And again, that's something that most kids, it's similar to what more kids experience than those sort of super over-the-top Friday Night Lights in Texas or Oklahoma and all that. So I was really trying to look at an experience that could represent a larger one.
Right. Towards that end, you also help us understand how the student body of New Rochelle High School and, to a large extent, the participants in its football program represent something of a melting pot as well, which also gives us a sense of this being, in some ways, a relatively ordinary, or maybe a better way to say it is maybe a highly representative sort of slice of the American population. Tell us more about that.
I think that that's absolutely true, exactly as you're portraying it. New Rochelle is a very diverse school. It's about 3,500 kids, so it's a big school. Suburban, but sort of urban in nature. It's a little bit of a mixture of both. And not only is it racially diverse, but it's socioeconomically diverse. You have kids on the team who are from the projects, and you have kids on the team who are from five-bedroom homes, you know, near the water and all of that. And yet they're together for these hours every day playing football. They're on the same offensive line or in the same linebacking core. They're working together in an often punishing activity. And it's really there's no question that the bonding experience that is an experience that bridges the gap for these kids, and that extends to the student body. You know, it extends to their friend groups. It extends to throughout the community. Of course, it doesn't touch the entire community when you have 3,500 kids, but there's no question that it can be an anchor and a strong community and a healthy community for a lot of people within and around the high school.
Tell us about the kind of access that you were given to this team, which you follow from well before the actual season begins, all the way through to the New York State playoffs. And we certainly get a sense from reading the book that you were on hand for so much of this team's time together. Just how unlimited was your access and how readily was it granted to you?
Well, it took a little bit of time for it to be granted. You know, it's as you mentioned before, I've done a couple of books in the past. I've been a Sports Illustrated for a long time, so I had a little bit of a record where they felt comfortable to at least begin to have the conversation. The coach had been there about 25 years. He's confident in what he does. He's confident in the way they go about things, which isn't always 100% perfect or politically correct, but it's always 100% principled, and he believes in his principles. So he wasn't afraid of being exposed for anything. I went early, you know, the spring before the season that I covered. I spent time there and got to know the coaching staff, got to know the athletic director and the principal, got to know some of the kids. And basically it was a matter of trust in terms of them, you know, not that it's in no way a press release for the school, and in many ways there are things in there that I'm sure they would rather I didn't report on, but I think they feel I was fair. I didn't go in there to take anybody down. I didn't go in there with, as we said earlier, with any particular agenda. And I was able, therefore, to get this access and just, you know, treat them fairly, listen to what they had to say and say what I had to say. And it really went well. And it was basically unfettered access. There were, you know, maybe one or two times when there were, like, really personal things that I was asked to not be around at. But I was there almost every day and really, you know, really part of the whole scene in a very intimate way, including going up to their preseason camp in a rural part of New York where they go away for 4 days and really get to know each other and play football in at the end of the summer, staying in camps. And I was able to be a part of that, which was a very intimate experience.
Right. These young players, for the most part, really come off as likable young people. I mean, we just are so glad to meet them. We want to know them better. I wonder, as you go into something like this, I should think maybe wait at the back of your mind might be the worry about, what are these kids really going to be like? And what is it going to feel like for me to have to paint honest portrayals in which some of them are arrogant, self-centered, blah blah blah, and share that as part of an honest portrait of who these players are. As it turns out, that seems not to be the case here. I mean, these are great kids, and we have a sense that you're not whitewashing away too many of their faults. I mean, they come off as human, but again, they are likable young people. Was that in a sense a pleasant surprise to you in any way, or maybe a sense of relief for you?
I think it was. That's an excellent point. There's no question that it was. And to be honest, again, as I say, this is an established program with a confident coach and a confident coaching staff. And if you are those things you're talking about, overly arrogant, dismissive, not you know, respectful of other people, you're just not going to last on this program. And so that is partly the environment that forced some kids who might have had other tendencies to behave the way they did. You still see, and it comes through in the book, that there's some people who will, ride other kids in a way that kids do, who might, flex their muscles figuratively and literally in a way that's a little bit unseemly. But for the most part, as you're saying, they were kids who wanted to be part of something together. The reason they stuck through this was to be a part of that team and to have their better selves come forward.
Right.
And I think it was gratifying for them.
And that has a lot to do, of course, with the head coach, whose name I'm not sure we've mentioned yet, Lou DiRienzo, who you really paint a portrait here of a coach who, even more than winning, cares about the team and about the team forming an unbreakable bond of solidarity and support for one another. That's really gratifying.
Yes, I mean, it's a balance, because he knows that things are better when you're winning, period, right? Like, so the kids feel better, the parents feel better. It's good to win, and he feels better. But it isn't at all costs, and it just won't be for him. And he knows that you're going to lose games, things are going to not go your way. And at that time, there's a big thing that he talks about and brings people into what's called the inner circle, meaning the people who are on the team, who are doing that work every day, know something about what they're doing and what they're going through that nobody else, including these kids' own parents and certainly all the sort of hangers-on around the program, can know. And building that trust within the group is really a crucial part of what he's doing. And that's the most important thing, as you allude to, even more than the wins and losses.
We're speaking with Kostya Kennedy about his book, Lasting Impact, One Team, One Season, What Happens When Our Sons Play Football. In the book, we follow the 2014 season of the New Rochelle High School Huguenots, a very successful football program at a high school in suburban New York City, led by a formidable coach by the name of Lou DiRienzo. One really interesting subplot, if we want to call it that, in the book, is that one of the most illustrious alums of this football program is NFL player Ray Rice, who is now, of course, infamously known for his arrest on, I don't remember if it was domestic violence charges or assault and battery, but a really, really terrible personal scandal for him. And I am impressed by the sensitive way with which you talk about Ray Rice and his situation against the larger context of domestic violence stories that we hear from certain NFL athletes. Talk for a moment about the nuance that you wanted to bring to this particular story and this particular aspect of it.
It was an amazing thing to be right at ground level of this event, terrible event, with Ray and his domestic violence, for an event that was talked about all over the world and on every video screen. You know, it's a horrible thing what he did and what we saw, and he would agree with that, and so would anybody around it. Ray, his father was killed when he was one. He had another father figure die when he was about nine. Grew up in a really tough area, and Coach DiRienzo, we were talking about, Ray came to Coach DiRienzo to play high school football and was there from 2000 to 2004, and the coach is still the principal father figure in Ray's life, without a question. So that when this happened, and this video went live in 2014, Coach DiRienzo's up in New Rochelle running his practice, and then he gets on a train afterwards and goes down to Baltimore, where Ray was living because he had been playing for the Baltimore Ravens. And Ray meets him at the train station at night and just walks over and says, "Coach, what are we going to do now?" It's still his family. It's still his who he turns to. And that aspect of it, Ray, in his time since leaving New Rochelle, had been incredibly active, financially, yes, but also just in time and visibility in the high school football program, in the public housing where he grew up, in the community at large, being present, being there to help people. And you saw when he was going through this, and when his wife, who everybody knew, they'd been dating since high school, was also clearly a victim here and was going through something quite serious, you saw the community, they weren't going to turn their back on this because of this one event, no matter what, how politically correct or incorrect that might be. They were going to accept Ray, as you know, condemn what he did, but not condemn the person and give him a chance to get back. And that's what he'd been trying to do, and that's what that was an amazing thing to see on the ground level, as I say. And it is a nuanced case, you know. People know him as a man and as a person and not just as a headline, and that's a big difference from the way, you know, most of the public knew and interpreted him.
Another story that is told here, of course, that we touched on in the introduction, is the specter of serious injury that is a very sad reality in just about all football programs of whatever stripe. And, of course, the aspect that is darkest of all on those tragic occasions when young people are actually killed while playing the game of football. And you spend a fair amount of time in the book on one such death. And some people may have read, as I did in the most recent issue of Sports Illustrated, an excerpt from your book which talks about the really tragic death of a fine young man by the name of Tom Cultinella. Briefly describe what happened to Tom and the way in which this story obviously resonated very, very powerfully with you.
It resonated with me, and it resonated in the football community at New Rochelle, although that was an hour or so away from Shoreham Wading River, Long Island, where Tom was a junior football player, an offensive guard and a linebacker, and he went in to make an ordinary hit in an ordinary game and got struck on the head and did not recover and did not make it. He didn't have any pre-existing condition or anything like that. And it was quite, to say the least, it was absolutely unnerving and troubling when something like this happened. I went out to the funeral where people throughout the community and throughout the wider football community came. Tom's father is a county policeman, and so there was a lot of that community there as well. He was a terrific kid playing a game that he loved. And, it's not likely, of course, that something like this is going to happen, but it is a possibility. And the risk of this happening in football is far, far, far greater than in any other high school sport. Now, you know, the most dangerous thing we can do with our kids is let them drive a car when they're 16 to 18, right? And a lot of kids do that out of necessity, and it's the reality of life. That's the most dangerous. That's the way the kids die, sadly, in tragic accidents at that age. But when you're playing football, there is a risk involved, and that echoed. And I think that every kid who plays football, they might not think about it very often, but they're aware that it's there. There's no way to not be. You can't go through practice and be getting hit on the head and knocked around and then hear this news, 13 kids in a 12-month period dying playing football, that it's not going to have some effect. And that certainly did have an effect far and wide when Tom died.
Briefly, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, when asked about whether or not it was safe for young people to play football, said, "If I had a son, I'd love to have him play the game of football. There's a risk in life. There's a risk in sitting on the couch." Some people appreciated what he had to say. Other people really took exception to the way in which he answered this really important question.
To me, there's just some tone deafness to that. I mean, of course I expect him to say, let his son play, as many of us would. It's a wonderful game, and there's a lot to be getting out of it. But to say in a press conference, which you have plenty of time to prepare for, to me what you want to say is, listen, I know that there's some risk in this game, and we're doing everything we can to make it safer and better. It's a beautiful game, and we want people to be able to play it and feel a little more comfortable. But to say that there's risk sitting on the couch, no, there's not. I mean, that's ridiculous. There's not risk sitting on the couch. There is risk playing football. And I happened to be in the home of Tom Cuttinella's parents on the morning when that quote was circulating and in their morning newspaper, and they were just dumbfounded. They were shocked that somebody would, that the commissioner of the NFL would say something so callous, as if, you know, as if there wasn't risk. I mean, and it's not a good sign. If that's truly the attitude, and I don't know that it is, it may have just been a statement, it's not a healthy attitude for football to have. They have to recognize that there are real risks and address them in a responsible way. That's not to overstate it, not to say that, hey, you're signing up for a death certificate if you play football. Far from that, right? There's 1.1 million kids who play, and a tiny, tiny percentage have actually die or have a catastrophic injury. But it is a risk, and it's a statistically significant risk, which sitting on a couch simply is not.
Right. You, in the final chapter of the book, not only wrestle with this sort of real-life question for you, I mean, do you want your own son playing football? But mm-hmm. you talk about 2014 perhaps being something of a tipping point for the game of football, especially high school football, as we come to grips with some of these questions. You also raise a very intriguing point about something which at one point you call an unhappy divide. That is the idea of the football game of football at the high school level becoming divided between the haves and the have-nots. That for certain young people desperate to advance in life and find a way to go to college, they might find themselves compelled to play football despite its risks, while others who are in a more privileged position can relinquish the game of football and play something much safer and sort of go on with their lives. Can you speak to that unhappy divide, if that's something that we are already seeing, and if so, just how serious a problem is that?
Well, I think it's definitely something to consider. It's a very uncomfortable thought. I mean, if we think about, just for a minute, think about boxing, what has boxing been all these years? It has been basically two men from a very underprivileged background, often from a minority group, standing in a ring, beating each other up, while people who have a lot of money are sitting in a ring outside watching them. And it's not a comfortable thought at all. Football right now still draws from all socioeconomic classes. Are we beginning to see that change? Perhaps a little bit. There is some indication there's a softening in certain communities of interest in playing football. But whether that's a long-lasting trend or just a short-term thing, it's just simply too early to say. But you can certainly see a scenario where it's people who see football as a way out, as an alternative that makes sense because it can lead them to advantages they wouldn't have playing it, whereas other people who are in a firmer footing in life might not. And I think that that's a real specter to be aware of if you're in football, And again, as I say, it is unhappy because I think football can provide great benefit for people at every level, and it shouldn't be something that only people play sort of out of a type of necessity rather than because of a want.
So in our last few moments, have you come to a complete resolution for yourself on this question on a personal level?
Well, I just for the record, I have two daughters, so I haven't had to specifically make this choice. I don't know how, you know, we all think about this from a moral standpoint, so that's not necessarily relevant. I think it's a very, very personal decision, and for me, it would depend on I wouldn't encourage my son to play if he didn't want to play, but if he did want to play and cared about the game and was ready for that commitment, and very importantly, if I felt that he was entering a program, whether that's first a youth program or then a high school program, with a responsible, good coaching staff, then I would feel comfortable letting him play, and I would see what he would get out of it. I'd, of course, monitor very carefully, see how he's feeling, really encourage him to be honest with me about anything. It's okay to say if he had a concussion. That's such a big hurdle, is getting kids to be honest about it. But if those circumstances were right, I could certainly see having my son play. If those circumstances weren't there, if it was not a program in my community that I respected, if my son was not ready for that commitment, then I certainly would not want him to play.
The book is Lasting Impact, One Team, One Season, What Happens When Our Sons Play Football, and the author, Kostya Kennedy. Thank you, Kostya Kennedy, for writing yet another fine book and for joining me today on The Morning Show.
My pleasure. Great to be on with you. Have a terrific day.
Thank you. The time is 8:37 exactly, and you're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. And now for the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show, we turn our attention to one of the most extraordinary athletes in competitive history, Michael Phelps. And, of course, Michael Phelps' astonishing career came to a triumphant close, or one presumes anyway, this is the close of a long and extraordinarily decorated career at the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro. One of the best ways to, in a sense, celebrate and re-celebrate the accomplishments of Michael Phelps and to learn a bit more about him is to take in hand a really wonderful booklet that's come out from Sports Illustrated called Michael Phelps, The Greatest Olympian. It gives a very helpful background on Michael Phelps, where he came from, his growing up years, his first Olympic experience at Sydney in 2000, where he finished just out of the medals, and then, of course, the way in which he progressed from strength to strength, from triumph to triumph in Athens, Beijing, London, and finally Rio, ending up with the undisputed title of most decorated Olympian of all time. I'm really grateful to be able to reconnect with Kostya Kennedy, who is editorial director at Time Inc. and a longtime senior writer at Sports Illustrated. And he is the one who has edited this really fine book, again called Michael Phelps, The Greatest Olympian. Kostya Kennedy, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Greg, so happy to be back on with you.
You were saying that in your capacity at Time Inc., which, of course, owns Sports Illustrated now, that one of your responsibilities is to help determine what sorts of important events and or accomplishments and or figures merits sort of special treatment in one of these special softbound books that we see so often now on newsstands. Tell us kind of about that process. And I suppose when it comes to somebody like Michael Phelps, there probably wasn't much in the way of debate necessary.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There is often always a little bit of a debate because you're committing to something, which means you're not committing to something else. And in this case, I think that when we started to see what Michael was doing in this year's Olympics, that's what made it really worthy of a piece and worthy of a bookazine, as we call it, in that it was a sort of crowning achievement in this incredible five Olympic career, and it also sort of closed up a narrative. You know, it hadn't been a straight shot to greatness for Michael Phelps. It was a little bit of that in the beginning, But in more recent times, he's struggled quite a bit. He entered rehab. He had some, you know, DUI arrests, and was really had a hard time re-solidifying himself. And the fact that he was able to do that and come back, and that he owned his mistakes and all of those things, made this a sort of an inspirational story as well as this incredible athletic achievement. I mean, to get the 5 more medals this year in the Olympics after all he'd done and prove himself to still be the most dominant male swimmer alive, again in his 5th Olympics, that's what sort of made us say, hey, look, this is something worth paying attention to, and it definitely was, and it's part of what made it such a pleasure to work on and be involved with.
Hmm. I suppose one of the most important decisions, beyond whether or not to do it at all, is the question then of how to do it, and
right.
of exactly what needed to be said or what needed to be covered or what aspects of the story of Michael Phelps might be worth, in a sense, special attention, room given in this bookazine. What kind of conversations occurred about that?
Well, one thing that was very important to me is that I wanted to feel that you had a full sense of what he had done. So every race is covered in here, not in a dutiful sense, but more in an experiential sense. We've had fortunate to have these incredible photographers at Sports Illustrated who were really at the forefront of what we see much more nowadays of the still photography underwater, looking up at the swimmers, and in this case Michael Phelps, and seeing the progression through the years of the races, I sort of wanted everything to be chronicled in that sense. So that was a big part of it, to make sure that it all adds up to even more. The sum really is more than just the parts when you begin to see the timing of what he did and the things that went into each race and the different strokes and all of that. So feeling that we really covered everything that he did as an athlete was very important. And then, again, when somebody has had as long of a career as he had, there was sort of his, you know, following his progression as a human being was also crucial. When you have an athlete, sometimes it's a little clearer because there are clear events, in this case the Olympics, that you pay attention to. And that sort of gave us the tent poles or the structure to work around. And that's sort of how we began to lay things out.
Hmm. One of the things I really appreciate about this and works like it, for instance, a very similar publication that came out a few years ago about the great Green Bay Packers quarterback Brett Favre, is that at least typically much of the text is in the form of essays and articles that have already been written, that were written at the time, at that moment in time when, for instance, Michael Phelps scored that extraordinary run of 8 gold medals at Beijing, or in the immediate aftermath of some of his personal difficulties like the DUI arrest and so on, that it isn't so much somebody looking back and putting it all into sort of grand perspective. It's more like we are along for the journey and are taken back to those moments in time and what it felt like and how the world viewed these accomplishments right in the moment. I suspect that that's not an accident, and it's not just for the sake of convenience that one turns back to what's already been written about somebody like Michael Phelps.
No, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with the way you're describing it. We do have some pieces here that are sort of, you know, of course, current, written now, and reflect upon what he has done. But there's almost no way to recreate the experience years later in the same way that it was experienced then. And so exactly what you're talking about, when the pieces about the Beijing Olympics are full of sort of the wonder and excitement that is happening, and you don't know it's going to happen. Now we know it has happened, and as amazing as it is, an element of drama simply is removed. When you go back and you read a story at the moment and of the time, that drama comes in full force. And it benefits from what we knew then, and I think, Greg, it also benefits from what we didn't know. There's sometimes a sense, I don't want to say naivety to the piece, it's just simply of not knowing what's going to happen. And so you just as anything we experience today is trapped in that time frame. And I think that's a huge, huge part of experiencing this and being able to sort of relive the moments. And as part of that, you're living in moments in the Olympics and in the world at large to some extent, right? Because everything is in context. So you're not just in Michael Phelps's world, you're also in the larger Olympic sports political world that he's traveling, and that is that's a big part of the energy, I think, of the book and what we are able to convey.
We're speaking with Kostya Kennedy, who edited this new bookazine from Sports Illustrated called Michael Phelps, The Greatest Olympian. I learned a lot in the chapter called Born to Swim, which gives us some background on Michael Phelps, including a little more background on something I already knew, namely that he is the product of a broken home, of parents who were divorced. And, of course, in the wake of that, he really ended up forging an exceptionally strong bond with his mother that persists to this very day. Something I did not know about Michael Phelps until I read your book is that at some point in his childhood, he was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder and, in fact, put on Ritalin for a time. I don't think this gets talked about very much. Is there much of a sense of how, if in any significant way, this has been a significant factor in his competitive career? And is it any kind of factor in the kind of competitor that he has turned out to be?
Yeah, I think it hasn't been talked about that much because, I mean, we do address it glancingly, and it's certainly something we've talked about and I've talked about with my writers and all that, is that it's very, very hard to say. You know, how here this incredible, incredible once-in-a-generation athlete who's physically built in this incredible way. He obviously was smaller as a child, but on his way to becoming 6'4" with a 6'7" wingspan, big hands, big feet, incredibly committed. So all of those things weigh in. So to say how much does the attention deficit disorder play in or not play in is simply, I don't think, it's certainly nobody that we spoke to, whether it's medical people or coaches, could say for sure that. What is true, clearly, is that his attention is clearly focused when he is swimming and when he is involved in the training, and he's able to commit and be clear on what, listen, people who have swum for any competitive way or run, say, or done other stamina-building exercises, it can be boring. It can be tough. You're in there and you're just doing it. At times he was swimming as much as 85,000 meters a week, and you have to sort of stay focused and stay on the beam, as it were. And I think that is clearly something that he's been able to do, and maybe it helped him escape some of that attention deficit issues. But it's very hard to say for certainty because he's such an anomaly, you know, that what goes into the making of Michael Phelps is a whole host of things.
Of course.
With their own contributing factors.
Right. Right. Something else I did not know about his earlier background is the devastating disappointment suffered by one of his older sisters back in 1996, when she appeared to be on track to make the U.S. Olympic team, but came into the U.S. trials with a sore back and ultimately finished out of the running and did not end up making it onto the Olympic team. Michael is quoted at one point as saying, "Nobody talks about 96," meaning that it was, and maybe to this day remains, an extraordinarily painful topic for everyone in that family. I wonder to what extent you think that had any contributing factor to Michael Phelps's competitive drive to achieve what he did.
I think that it was a reminder of how close he or anyone can be to not having it work out. I mean, the history of sports and the currency of sports is filled with just misses, with things that just didn't quite happen. His sister Corinne was a very, very good swimmer, so who knows what might have happened. And so to have been involved in that way and seen the disappointment is clearly left a mark and clearly made Michael want to leave as little to chance as he possibly could. And that's part of why he's so good in so many different races at different lengths in different strokes. Because he just didn't want to have the chance that things might not work. And I think that there's no question that that did play a role in his approach and development.
Mm. One thing I came away from your book appreciating much more than I ever did before was Michael Phelps's exceptional versatility. This really sets him apart from just about any swimmer who came before him. Explain, in a sense, the sort of the length and breadth and depth of his versatility as a swimmer, particularly at the height of his powers. I mean, and the way in which this simply wasn't true of other distinguished swimmers of his and previous generations.
Right. Well, when you look at what he did, particularly, let's just look at Beijing, right? So he wins the individual medley, which is a combination of four strokes and world record time. He wins the freestyle relay. He wins his own freestyle. He wins the butterfly. The butterfly at different lengths, right? So he wins the butterfly at 200 meters, at 100 meters. You do see overlap among all swimmers. They do often compete in more than one distance and often more than one stroke. But that breadth of ability is really, really just rare and uncommon. I mean, when you look at the all-time medal winners, Michael Phelps had earned 28 Olympic medals, and the next most is 18. And that in itself tells you how incredible his versatility is. The next most for a swimmer is 12, and that's quite a lot, right? Natalie Coughlin, a female swimmer for the U.S., won 12 medals. But he's won 2.5 times as many as that, just about.
Right.
So it shows you how versatile he is. And swimming is a sport where there is most of the top career medal holders are in gymnastics or swimming, because there are enough events that you can compete in different ways and opportunities to win different medals. But even in that context, Michael Phelps is absolutely rare, not only rare, but unique.
Right. Well, being able to master so many different kinds of strokes, and at one point, your booklet talks about that moment when his coach realized that Michael Phelps no longer has a weak stroke, and most swimmers have at least one, and probably several. And at the zenith, at the height of his powers, Michael Phelps really could do anything in the pool. Your book explores the relationship between Michael Phelps and his longtime coach Bob Bauman, and it was a relationship that was not always easy. I think at one point it said there has been love and there has been loathing.
Right.
And there's something almost kind of encouraging about seeing how complex this relationship was and how it weathered a whole lot of difficulties.
Yeah, you know, so Coach Bowman came in, and he was, as we talked about earlier, Michael Phelps was estranged from his father, and so Coach Bowman had took on some of that role as well, not just being a coach, but also being a father figure. And that leads to its own set of expectations, obviously, and its own potential set of difficulties. When you're a really good coach for somebody, particularly in individual sports, you're not only their coach, you're also, in a sense, their tormentor. You're trying to get them in the pool at times when he doesn't want to get in the pool. He's trying to get him to push when it was really, really hard to push, even for somebody as committed as Michael Phelps. Listen, there's days when it's just you don't feel great and it's hard and you just don't want to go swim another 10,000 meters that day, but there was Bob Bowman making sure he did. And I think a lot of that came through in sometimes intention in their relationship. Ultimately, they love each other and need each other professionally, And Michael Phelps has huge respect for Bob Bowman, followed him to train at Michigan, and will continue to be involved with him. But certainly there were times when that tension got to be difficult, and he didn't want to always listen to him. And when Michael Phelps wanted to come back for the 2016 Olympics, at first Coach Bowman did not want to take him on. He wasn't sure if he believed that Phelps had the commitment necessary. But they both sort of, you know, they're both stubborn in their way, and were able to make this work, obviously, in spectacular fashion.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I especially appreciate among the many marvelous photographs here are several different images that capture Michael Phelps as an absolutely exemplary teammate, colleague, competitor, friend, mm-hmm. whether he is accepting the accolades of a competitor from the Japanese team with this warm smile on his face, or hugging various teammates, and we read about his many charitable exploits, which seem to have sprung from a very sincere place in his heart. For all that he has accomplished, he seems to have done so with a very good heart and with a fair amount of humility. Talk for a moment about this aspect of the Michael Phelps story.
Yeah, I think that his own life circumstances, some of which we've touched on, taught him that humility, and also simply knowing how hard it is to swim and to do it at that level gave him a sense. He's humbled by the pool. And particularly later in his career, the past couple of Olympics, he really understood how hard it was. You know, it was, compared to many people, relatively came easy, relatively, and I mean that with quotes around it, to Michael Phelps when he was younger. But he sees how hard it is, and he really respects the people who are out there. Listen, anybody in the Olympics, not everybody's training quite as hard as Michael Phelps, but everybody is involved in a brutally difficult training regimen and is deeply committed. And I think that's what Michael Phelps respects more than anything, that commitment. Let me answer me. How fast do you think Michael Phelps has ever swum, like in a race, in miles per hour?
Oh, I don't have any idea. That's an interesting question.
Go ahead and guess. I was totally wrong when I guessed, so don't feel...
I don't have any idea what to even...
Okay, so I'll tell you. It's 6 miles an hour.
Wow. I was going to say something like, you know, 3 or 4 miles an hour or something. I didn't even know what in the world to say. Wow.
And how fast do you think that a sailfish swims? A fairly fast, but... You know,
I'm even less able to venture a guess on that.
So I'll throw it out, Greg. 68 miles an hour. So here's the fastest human who's ever swum, at least in recorded time, who swims at 6 miles an hour. That's the fastest he's ever swum. And then you get an ordinary sailfish that can swim along at 68 miles an hour. And I bring that up because it shows that swimming is hard for human beings. Yes, we can do it, and yes, we've done it, but we're not built for this. Our bodies are not made for the water. We obviously don't breathe in the water, all of that, and it underscores how difficult it is to actually do what he's doing. Mm. And he knows that anybody else who swims has that similar difficulty, and that is what he truly respects about people who do the sport and about the sport itself.
Mm. Well, we can... re-celebrate all that he accomplished in this marvelous new bookazine from Sports Illustrated called Michael Phelps, The Greatest Olympian. And the book published by Time Incorporated and edited by Kostya Kennedy. Kostya Kennedy, thank you so much for the time you've given me today and for this opportunity to talk about the great Michael Phelps. Best wishes.
Best wishes to you too. My pleasure to be on with you.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also